Session number 12895, rule 4.
Crew Captain Wilson MacDonald, reel 4.
Peter von Poller and I, we decided we would attack this. We knew the new split was very heavily defended with anti-aircraft guns, because it was a very difficult target for the Navy to do anything about. Anyway, we went inland, and we then started to come out towards Split Harbour. And I said to Peter, well, we'll both attack at the same time, come up on my right-hand side, and we'll attack, and we'll aim below the waterline as much as possible, try and sink this ship, because we can't really do much damage to the above waterline. I think I'd explained all this to before we left ground, anyway. But anyway, so that was the idea. So we went in and attacked the torpedo boat, and as we went out, all the anti-aircraft fire started to fire at us, and the machine gun fire and everything. They really, they couldn't have known we were going to attack them at that time, but anyway, they were all prepared. They must have, but we'll say they were very much on their alert. And so, as we went into, we went out low level, do you see? And then we went into a swing like that. And an 88 shell from one of the ground forces hit my starboard wing, and which was full of cannon ammunition. And it exploded, went through, not the panel off, flew into my ammunition, and exploded all the ammunition in my right-hand wing. And I managed to get the aeroplane back to Bufferdo, and I landed, and the aeroplane never flew again. They said it was a write-off. And so... Anyway, we thought no more, Peter and I thought no more about it, but a day later, or 2 days later, Bari headquarters rang me up and said, you sank the E-boat. We'd sank her in the harbour, and the Royal Navy were delighted, because that was one less target for them to destroy. So that was our little escapade in support of the Royal Navy. So and then... Sorry, I beg your pardon.
Carry on.
Oh, well, we're getting to the end of the war, as far as I was concerned.
But when you were commanding that wing...
Yes.
Liked to do a lot of flying, did you?
I did a lot of flying, yes. I did leading that wing practically all the time, as much as possible. But we didn't do many... any more big raids. It was more or less pocket stuff. On Bufferno, there was another wing on Bufferno of Italians on the airfield of Bufferno. They were flying... What were they flying? They were flying Marauders, I think. I think they were flying American aeroplanes. I didn't have anything to do with them. They were an Italian outfit which were sharing the wing with me, sharing the airfield with me. But they were Italians. And
how did you like flying the Mustang?
Oh, I loved the Mustang. It was the nicest airplane at that time. It was, to me, it was a better airplane than the Spitfire. That's
Why?
Saying something. Because it had wonderful range. It had long range. The Spitfire had no range worth talking about. The Mustang was a beautiful aeroplane. It had a Rolls-Royce engine, and it was a beautiful aeroplane to fly. And it was a beautiful fighting aeroplane. And to say it's a better fighter than the Spitfire, it's not unfair to say that. I think the Spitfire was, for the job that we had to do in the Battle of Britain, the Spitfire was a better aeroplane than the Mustang. The Mustang would come somewhere between the Spitfire and the Hurricane. Between the Spitfire and the Hurricane, had we had the Mustang at that time, but of course we didn't have it till I was fighting in Italy. So, but for its job of low-flying attacks against the Germans in Yugoslavia, in the support of the partisans, it was ideal. It was a beautiful aeroplane because it had those long range. The Spitfire didn't have anything like that range. And we had about a 7-hour range, whereas the Spitfire only had about 2 hours at the maximum. Even with overloaded tanks, I don't think the Spitfire was ever able to do much more than 2 or 3 hours for the Mustang. The Germans used a big part, what am I talking about? The Americans used to, they of course were using Mustangs in support on the working from England. American fighters had Mustangs too.
Did the German Air Force make any appearance in opposition over the Balkans?
The German Air Force, no. We saw a Fieser Storch on one occasion. It must have been carrying an American general, we thought. But we were told we should have shot it down. We didn't get close enough to it. It was a German Fieser Storch, which was on its way down to Greece, I think. And they thought it was carrying, the partisans thought it was carrying an American general.
A German general.
German general, yes. A big opponent. Yes, I'm getting confused. The partisans thought that they had intercepted some information that a new general was due to take over command of the forces of the Germans in Greece at that time, in order to do the evacuation of Greece and Yugoslavia right back, to bring the forces right back. And in fact, they realized, I think, the war was coming to an end. This new general was to take the forces, to get the German forces to move out of Greece in order. Because we intercepted a huge force of Germans in Yugoslavia, where they were held up by a bridge which we attacked, and which the partisans were on one side of the bridge and the Germans on the other. And this bridge was over a very, very deep river, very deep gully. And it was a vital bridge to destroy. And we attacked it, and the partisans attacked it. And they held the Germans up there for a number of days before the bridge was eventually destroyed. So, in fact, when I say the bridge was destroyed, and that I'm not certain of, because we did not attack it anymore. Whether the partisans destroyed it or not, that I'm not sure. Anyway, the Germans had started their big withdrawal from that area of the war.
How did you like doing the work escorting the B-51s?
Well, we only took them so far, and we thought that was quite fun. We never really came in much contact with them. We sat above them. We were there in case they were attacked by the Germans. So we never really never took them far enough. We just took them up to beyond Trieste, where they were then picked up by the American fighters. beg your pardon, the German, the American had fighters, operating in Italy as well, which did support them. They were black. Black wings. There was one big black wing of Mustang fighters commanded by an American colonel. Huge big buck man, American colonel. And the interesting thing was that they were flying Mustangs the same as we were. And we were short. If we were short of supplies at any time, I used to go to the American black colonel on the airfield just beyond us, and I would say to him, "We're short of these various supplies for our airplanes." And he would say, "Any supplies? Just send your supply. Send your engineer officer along to see mine, and if we have any supplies, we will gladly give them to you with no paperwork. You just come and help yourself from our stores." We were short of supplies. They were being black Americans. They were terribly well looked after. They had the best of everything. They had the best of equipment. And they were never short of airplanes or pilots or ground crews. They had a huge force of support for their operations. And so that was the American forces. So they had Enforger supporting the... We were just supernumerary to the force which supported the B-51s on their operations to Germany.
Could we finish up by you telling me something about where you were born and something
about your family
background?
Yes. I was born in Oban, in Argyllshire, on the west coast of Scotland. My father was a doctor there. And I had a brother, and just two of us. And I was educated in Scotland, and then I left there. When I was about 14, there was a man called Francis Patmore. He was the son of Coventry Patmore, the poet. And he had been a soldier in the First World War. And he had, after the war, he had gone to Kenya and set up a coffee plantation there, which was known as a soldier settlement plantation. After the war, after the First World War, the officers were given the opportunity of moving into Kenya, which was German West Africa, as it had been during the war, during the First World War. And so Francis Patmore was a patient of my father's, and he said, I used to go shooting with him, and he said to my father, well, like I said, he wanted someone, he wasn't married, and he wanted someone to come out, some young person to come out and help him with his coffee plantation. So at 17, I went out to Kenya this was in 1929. I went out to join up with Francis Patmore to run his farm, run his coffee plantation. And there I stayed for 2 years, a year and a half, I think. This was during the First World War slump of the 30s, which you won't remember. You won't remember the world before you were born.
No, but I know about it.
So I spent 18 months up there, out there with him, and then things went from bad to worse, and he lost his money, first of all, and he couldn't afford to keep the plantation going. And then he got very ill with Blackwater fever, and he got terribly ill and had to go to hospital. And it was during the time he went to hospital, and I tried to keep the fort going. And then he had taken on a partner which ran a sisal factory, and had put a lot of money into the sisal factory with a man called Block, who was a man from Nairobi, ran a hotel in Nairobi. And anyway, things went from bad to worse. And my father came out. My father and mother came out on a tour. They were doing a tour around Africa. And they came up, and my father said, "Look, you better give up this business and come home. It's hopeless." So I went home, and I thought, my father said, "Well, why don't you study medicine?" Well, fall into his footsteps. My brother was a banker and didn't study medicine. And so I went and started to study, and it was during that time that I was studying for medicine, and I thought, well, I don't know. I got the idea, I'd like to join the Air Force. I'd always had an idea, right when I was a young boy, of flying, because in Oban, where I was born, the flying boats used to come up from Calshot to Oban, and they used to come every summer, two or three or four flying boats used to come up. And on one occasion, when I was quite young, I can't remember the age, a cousin of mine was in command of one of these flying boats, and he took me flying in this flying boat. And that was how I first got the idea of wanting to fly. That was before, of course, I went to Africa. When I came back and I started studying medicine, and I found that medicine wasn't really what I wanted, and more mechanical. My grandfather was an engineer. My father's father was an engineer, and he invented, I think, he was a chief engineer to John Brown's shipyard on the Clyde. And he invented the endless dredger. You know the endless dredger? He invented, yes. I've got his copies of his original patents. He patented this dredger to start building the Panama Canal. And he took two of these dredgers out to start the Panama Canal. That's digressing, isn't it?
Yes, but it's background to why you had the mechanical interest in to go into flying.
Right, you are. All right. So my grandfather took these two endless dredgers out, but he hadn't realized how difficult the Panama Canal was going to be. It wasn't going to be like the Suez Canal, which was sand. It was going to be rock. So these two endless dredgers got in a bit of trouble. And he sold these endless dredgers off, and he'd given up John Brown's by this time. He then went to the Argentine, where he set up an estancia in the Argentine. And he got two of his sons to come out from Glasgow and joined him out there. And my father, of course, stayed in Glasgow with his mother and a number of the family. It was quite a big family. I think it was a family of 10 my father came from. And anyway, the father, my grandfather, my father's father, went out to South America and started down. And he went off to discover, he went off on horseback down and discovered Patagonia. And I've got the letter that he wrote, a huge screed that he wrote to the British government, saying that Patagonia was the most wonderful area for cultivation, for sheep farming. and it should be colonized by the British government. And he then went back to the Argentine. I've got the copies of the letters that he wrote, and I've also got copies of his dredger, the endless dredger that he made in Glasgow. The copyrights of building this endless dredger. I've got all that upstairs. And anyway, that's digressing. He stayed on out there with his two sons in the Argentine. And there they built up the Argentine. Beef. He started beef. And He married an English woman. She was a Forbes Robertson, who was my Aunt Anne. And so he stayed out there, and he had two sons that were born out there and were educated in England, but they were South American subjects. And when war was declared, they both joined up. They were my two first cousins. Both joined up in the Royal Air Force and were both killed in the early part of the war.
One thing we've missed out, if you can tell me, is whereabouts you were educated.
I was educated in Oban. I was educated in the Oban High School, and my father sent him down to couldn't have sent further away to what's the name of the
South Coast?
Bristol. What's the
Clifton?
Clifton College. That's right. Which had been evacuated by this time to Harrogate. So we all went down to Harrogate, and I was supposed to be left there too, but for some reason I got ill, and I couldn't stay there. My brother stayed there, and there was another friend of my father's called Colonel Starkey, who was in Oban area. His son, Stanton Starkey, he and Alistair, my brother, they were both left there at Harrogate to go into Clifton College. And there my brother stayed, and I had to come back with my mother. This is during the war, First World War, presumably, is it? Are we thinking about the First World War or just after?
Well, you were born in 1912.
Yeah, born in 1912, that's right. This would be, I was 14, I suppose, at that time.
1926.
That would be 1926. That would be about right. That was when my
mother
went.
Did you go to school in Harrogate?
Big one?
Did you go to school in Harrogate?
I never went to school. My brother did. My brother went to Clifton College. And I was due to stay there, but I got ill. And I had to come back. My mother brought me back to Oban. And there I went back. Then I went to the Oban High School. Went to Oban High School in Oban. And there I stayed until I went to Africa. So I was educated.
So all your education was at Oban?
Big fun?
All your schooling was at Oban? All your schooling was
All my schooling in was Oban. In Oban, that's right. A lot of it was, I was very ill in Oban, and a lot of my education was private education. I started off with private education, and then I got ill, and then I went to the local board school, which was Oban High School, and then I got ill again, and then I had a private education before I went to Africa.
So by private education, you mean a private tutor?
Private tutor, that's right, yes, private tutor. So I had a lot of private education. I was very ill with pneumonia and pleurisy, and I was really at death's door for a lot of the time of my early part of my life. And so I never got to Clifton College with my brother. Although I was got down as far as there and got ill, and then I had to be brought back home again. So that was it. My mother was the uncle was the chief of the McLean clan. My mother's uncle was Murdoch McLean, the chief of the McLean's clan in Mull, That's where she met my father. That's where she met. She was up staying with her uncle in Mull. And my father was a doctor in Mull before he went to Oban. And so that's why I was born in Oban, because they moved to Oban. That was it. My mother's father, she was half English and half Scottish. Scottish side I've just mentioned to you. Her father was a colonel in the Royal Horse Artillery, and she was born and bred at Norwood down here. And that's why, and then she left there, went up to stay with her uncle. She's a McLean Khan. And that's where she met my father. And that's when everything began to happen as far as I was concerned.